Well, I'm on television, so this is great. I don't have the coronavirus. I've got a cough, and it's been hanging around for a while. So we thought it was better for everyone if I wasn't doing this up the front of the church. So hopefully you understand. Hopefully it'll be fine. Works great for me. I can preach, and I don't have to see another human being. I feel like I've been preparing for this my whole life. So this works for me. So hopefully it works for you guys as well. So maybe this thing will be happening a lot more in the future as we sort of adapt to what's going on. So hopefully you've heard the passage, and you know we're continuing with our sermon, our series on 1 Peter, 1 Peter 4, 1 to 11. I hope many of you may know the story of Jesus, know the Gospels. Well, there's a story in the Gospels about a woman from Cana, Canaanite woman. We don't really know anything about her. It's from the country sort of north of Palestine, and we know little about her, just that the Canaanites were kind of the enemies of the people of God. And we read in the Gospels about how she comes to Jesus, and we know she has a daughter. Because she comes to Jesus and says, "My daughter is not well. She's possessed by a demon. Can you heal her?" That's all we know. So maybe she was married once. We don't know. We don't know anything about her family. We don't know anything about her at all. Just that this Canaanite woman has a daughter who is demon possessed, and she asked Jesus to heal her daughter. And Jesus' response is actually, he's reluctant at first. He kind of says, "No, because I've come to the people of God. I've come to the children of God. I haven't come to their enemies. That's who my priority." But she persists. She comes back and says, "No, Jesus, I want you to do this." And he says, "No." And she eventually says, "Well, what about grace? Isn't there enough grace in God's kingdom for even the enemies of the people of God?" And Jesus is touched by this, I suppose, and he heals her daughter. And what he says to her, he says, "You have great faith." That's all we know about her. We don't know her name, we don't know her circumstances, we know nothing about her. What we know, however, is that Jesus said to her, "You have great faith." That's not bad, is it? Like, that's not a bad way to be remembered. If that's the only thing that people know about you, that's the only sort of mark you leave in history, is that Jesus says you have great faith. That's pretty good. I think that's all right. And Peter is writing to these scattered exiles in Asia Minor, in modern day Turkey. We've heard about this story. We know they're being persecuted. And he writes, and he says in this, he says, "Look, they don't understand. They don't understand what's going on. They don't understand who you are. And don't expect them to understand. They'll look at you and they say, 'What's wrong with you? Why aren't you just joining in with the things we're doing?' We know what's wrong with you. You've got religion." And they'll kind of sneer at you and laugh at you and mock you a bit behind your backs, things like that. They'll belittle you. But Peter says, don't worry about that. You know, they live as though life is short, life is fragile. Why, you know, we're going to die. We just need to get on with life, enjoying the things we've got. Why would you commit your life to something that denies you pleasure or just makes life harder for you? Why would you willingly put yourself in a minority and not just embrace what the majority is doing and just make your life easier? Why would you do that? And Peter says, this is why. Because at the end of it all waits a God who is going to judge you for how you've lived. And don't you want to be able to stand before God at the end of all things and hear him say, "You have great faith"? Isn't that worth waiting for? Isn't that what what we should be living for? Isn't that what we should be looking forward to? This is what Peter is encouraging the church with, is that the world around you don't understand. They will judge you. They will make judgments about you. But God waits, and he will make his own judgments about you and how you've lived. And don't you want to live for that? Don't you want to live for God's approval rather than the approval of people? Peter says that even before Jesus came, God was preaching grace. God was preaching his gospel. He says that the gospel of hope, the gospel of faith was being proclaimed to those who are now dead, to those who died even before they saw Jesus. Peter kind of refers a bit to this, if you remember, in the first chapter, where he talks about the prophets and those who were waiting to see this moment. And they didn't get to see it, but you did. But they were waiting, they were anticipating it, because they already had caught, if you like, a vision of God's grace and the hope that was coming. And Peter says, you know, God's been proclaiming grace all this time. And what do people do? People dismiss it. And people not only dismiss it, they judge those who embrace it. They judge those who say, I want there to be more to life. I want my life to mean something. I want to do more with my life. I want my life to count. They judge those who do that and sort of dismiss them and mock them and ridicule them. And people might say, like in the time that Peter was writing or now, people may look at followers of Jesus and may look at Christians and they may say, oh, the Christians, they were all right. You know, they were quite good in some parts, but they were a bit confused. They didn't really understand. They believed some weird things. they might say, oh, Christians were great. They were generous. They were kind. They were good. They might say, you know, Christians are dangerous people, deluded people, troublemakers, stupid idiots. People will say all these things about followers of Jesus. They'll say all these things about who the church was in Peter's time, about who we are. They'll make all these judgments. And Peter says that actually, in the end, it is God's approval. It is God's judgment that matters. That is what we should be living for. That's what we should be seeking. If you've seen the headlines, which I imagine most of you have, death kind of comes up a lot. And you can see even in the way the coronavirus has been handled, we'll get, if a celebrity gets it, we know exactly who they are. Tom Hanks and his wife Rita have got it. Justin Trudeau. It's Friday when I'm recording this, and this morning, news headlines, Justin Trudeau and his wife have been diagnosed with the coronavirus. But there are obviously thousands of people who've got it, and we don't know their names. We don't know who they are, but we know the celebrities who've got it. And when the celebrities, you know, when a celebrity dies, we know everything. They're on the headlines. We get all the details. We read all the Twitter accounts, the tweets, you know, talking about how sad people are and what wonderful person this was. And yet, you know, the coronavirus, thousands have died and we don't know who they are. They don't get a headline. They don't get an individual sort of article explaining what a wonderful person they were. There's a huge disparity in our disparity, that's the word there. A huge disparity between how certain people are remembered in our society, how famous people are remembered and how, you know, ordinary people are remembered. But the argument Peter makes is that all of us will be remembered by God. It doesn't matter how the world remembers you. What matters is how God remembers you. And God, you know, doesn't read the headlines. In that regard, God does not care more about Tom Hanks than he does about any other person around the world. And the Canaanite woman that we heard about earlier, that I mentioned at the beginning, we don't know about her family, we don't know her community, we don't know what they thought of her, we don't know what they would have said about her when she passed away, when she died. We don't know if anyone would have gone to her funeral and talked about how wonderful she was. We don't know any of that, but what we do know is that Jesus said, you have great faith. That's what we know. That's what we remember about her. And there's sometimes conflict, I think, between how the world looks at us, how the world remembers us, and how God remembers us, how God looks at us. And Peter says to the church, and he says the same to us, seek God's approval, not the approval of people. That's what we should be doing. We should be seeking God's approval. And in the passage we've read, at the end of that passage, they're just... four things that he kind of highlights, if you like, little ways he says of saying, look, if you want to seek God's approval, this is a way to do it. Here are four ways to do it. So for the rest of this sermon, I'm going to cover those four ways. So you get, you know, four mini sermons now, good value for money, I'm sure. And we'll think about this. What's the first thing Peter says? The first thing he says, I'm going to grab my Bible because I don't think you've got slides up, so I'll just tell you here what he says. He says, the end of all things is near. Therefore, be clear-minded and self-controlled so that you can pray. Okay, so the first thing Peter says is pretty simple. If you want God's approval, seek God's approval. If you want to be known by God and know God, then know him. Make yourself known to him. Be self-controlled, be clear-minded so that you can pray. If you remember when I spoke last time about passage in 3 where Peter talks about husbands and wives, one of the things he talks about to the husbands is, you know, live this way so that nothing will hinder your prayers. This idea that our actions can hinder our relationship with God. And in the same way, Peter says here, look, if you want to... if you want to get God's approval, then make sure you are seeking God. Okay, make sure you are investing time and energy and space into your relationship with God. That sounds important. He says, make sure you're in a right relationship with God so that you may be alive to God in regard to the Spirit. And that sounds important. And you think, well, this is important. Obviously, what's more important than nurturing our relationship with God? Clearly, you know, this is the first thing Peter mentions, this idea of keeping open the communication channels with God. But you know what? The second thing, Peter actually says there is something that is even more important than that. He says in verse 8, above all, he begins, above all. So above all, this is more important. This is the important thing that follows. Above all, if you're only going to do one of these things, this is the one to do. Above all, love each other deeply. Because love covers over a multitude of sins. That's what he says. Above all, love each other deeply. Because love covers over a multitude of sins. What does that mean, do you think? Love covers over a multitude of sins. I think it means something similar, I guess, to what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13 when he writes, love does not keep a record of wrongs. I think it means the same kind of thing. People are going to annoy you, they're going to disappoint you, they're going to let you down, they're going to offend you, they're going to upset you. And Peter says, love them. Love them. If you love them, if you love someone, if you love your brothers and sisters around you, you do not become obsessed with their failings. You do not hold on to the different ways in which they've let you down. And Peter says that, remember, above all, this is how we should be living. I spoke a few weeks ago about the link between our love for each other and our love for God, that you can't really have one without the other. You can't say you love God and yet not love the people around you. And the same thing here, Peter is making that same point. Your relationship with God depends on your ability to love those around you. We shouldn't be the type of people who see the worst in those around us, who hold on and sort of lay hold of other people's mistakes. That's not who we should be, because that's not love. When I think about this thing that Peter says, It reminds me of Peter's own story. If you know the story of Peter, he's a fisherman. And if you look in Luke's gospel at how he meets Jesus, Luke chapter 5, they've been fishing, he and his brother and James and John, the others, they've been fishing and they've not caught anything. And Jesus comes along and says, let's go out and let's do some fishing over there. And they say, well, all right, because it's you, Jesus. You know, they obviously heard, Jesus has developed a bit of a reputation. So they decide, okay, because it's you, we'll go out. But we've not caught anything. And if you know the story, you'll know they head out and they throw their nets over. And the nets are full to bursting with fish. And they pull them in and they go ashore. And in Luke 5, do you remember what Peter does next? Do you know what Peter does? Peter falls on his knees and he says to Jesus, get away from me, Lord, for I'm a sinful man. Get away from me, Lord, for I'm a sinful man. And that little encounter with Jesus and what Peter, the same Peter, the Peter who was the guy who fell on his knees and said, get away from me, Lord, for I'm a sinful man, is the same Peter who writes this, above all, love each other, for love covers over a multitude of sins. This same Peter has this encounter with Jesus, and we realise that as you draw closer to Jesus, as when you have an encounter to Jesus, whose sin are you most aware of? Peter doesn't say, Lord, get away from me. My brother is really, really annoying. He doesn't say, Lord, get away from me. These other guys are idiots. He says, Lord, get away from me, for I am a sinful man. And I think it's impossible to draw close to Jesus and yet be more aware of other people's failings and faults and sins than our own. I think it's really difficult to do that. And the other thing this makes me think of is this whole idea, love covers over a multitude of sins. This is Peter's story. If you know Peter, if you know his story, you know that the Gospels are full of the ways in which he failed to grasp it. He failed to follow through. How he let Jesus down when Jesus needed him. How they fell asleep. He didn't understand what was happening. He betrayed Jesus. He lied about knowing him. All these things. And even in the New Testament, you know, you think, this is the new Peter, the Peter who has the Holy Spirit after Pentecost, the Peter who preaches the sermon in Acts sort of chapter 2. This is the new Peter. Even this new Peter made mistakes, because Paul tells us in Galatians, he talks about a time, you know, Peter was misled, led astray by some visitors to Jerusalem, and Paul himself had to stand up and publicly kind of say to Peter, you've gone wrong, Peter, you're doing it wrong. So Peter, I think this is Peter's life. Love covers over a multitude of sins. He knows, I think, firsthand how much he needs his brothers and sisters to bear his sins, to not focus on, not hold his own sins against him. I think this is Peter's life. And this is why, one of the reasons why I think he says, look, this is the most important thing. I know firsthand how love transforms someone. I know how Jesus' love transformed me. I know how the love and acceptance of my brothers and sisters transform me. Love covers over a multitude of sins. You know, it's an easy way to seek people's approval, the approval of people, by finding out what they don't like and saying, oh yeah, I don't like that too. Oh, you have a problem with that person in the church. So do I. And you can bond over your criticism of one another. But that is not true community. That is not true bonding. Because it is love that creates true community. And love covers over a multitude of sins. It does not hold on to another sin. So the third thing. The next thing Peter says, offer one another hospitality without grumbling. Enough said. I'm not going to say any more on that. I'm just going to leave it hanging there in case the Holy Spirit wants to say, that's the one. That's the one you need to think about. Offer one another hospitality without grumbling. The fourth one, the final one, Peter says, use your gifts for God. If you want God's approval, use your gifts for God. Now, I write. Some of you may know I write. I try to write. I'm kind of reluctant to call myself a writer because I feel like I'm still new to it. I'm still learning. And I think probably most writers feel like they're always learning. Maybe you should always feel like that. But I'm trying to write. And I've always been interested. I've always had a passion for writing. I was, you know, if I went to school when I was younger and the teacher said, right, today you're gonna write a story. That's what you're going to do. Yeah, that was a good day for me. I love that. That's what I loved. I would do that for fun. In my free time, I would write stories. Wow. And I've always been like that, but I never really thought much about that as a gift. I never really took it seriously, I suppose. But I remember very well the exact moment I realised I had to take this seriously. And I was in Australia, and I was sitting in a room waiting for Pete. You may remember Pete. I mentioned him a few weeks ago. He was the guy who went into the shop and asked that guy the question along the lines of, if, you know, if it's true to say we can never find happiness in this life, is it fair to conclude that we were made for another life? That guy. He does stuff like that all the time. And one day we're waiting for a lecture, and he's doing a lecture on leadership or something like that. And he comes in and he's visibly agitated, like he's kind of stomping around a bit, and he's got this cloudy look on his face, like he's angry about something. Don't know what that's about. And then before he starts his lecture, he just kind of says this throwaway line to us in the class. He says, some of you are frustrating God because you are not using your gifts. And then he kind of just got on with the lecture, got on with the day, and it was never mentioned again. But I tell you, that at that moment, it was like the Holy Spirit said, yeah, James, that's you. I'm talking to you. You are frustrating me because I've given you this gift, I've given you this passion to write, and you're not doing anything with it. And from that moment on, that was really the moment that kind of changed my attitude towards it. And I went away and thought and tried and practiced and tried to do something with it. What does Peter say the purpose of God's gifts are? What does he say? He says, each one should use whatever gift he has received to serve others, faithfully administering God's grace in its various forms. That's why God gives us gifts. That is why he's given you a gift, to serve and to administer his grace. Have you ever thought about that before? Have you ever really understood that the things you're good at, the things God's given you to do, he has given you to do them so that you may bring his grace to others around you? That's why you have them. That's their purpose. Have you ever understood that? Have you ever thought about that? One of the, again, an easy thing to do, and a thing that most of us do most of the time, is we use our gifts to get the approval, not of God, but of people. We use our gifts in order to impress people, or to make people like us, or to convince people to give us money. We think that's what the gifts are for. So that, like us, but Peter says, no, they've been given to you so that you could serve others and spread God's grace around. And now when we think about our gifts and think about sharing God's grace with others, we probably typically think straight away about, well, how can I use my gift in church? You know, well, I'm musical, so I'll join the worship band. I can speak, so I'll preach. Whatever. That's what we think about. And there's nothing wrong with those things in it said, but you know what? I think that is too small. We are thinking too small, because if God has given us gifts in order to administer his grace, it's not just this group of people that he wants to administer grace to. Do you remember what we were thinking about? These concepts of holiness. We are to be holy, we're to be set apart. Why? For the purpose, for the mission of reaching the whole world. And I think God gives us gifts so that we can administer his grace, not just to each other, but to the whole world. And I think maybe we need to think bigger about what we do with our gifts. That we go to God and say, God, you've given me this gift. How can I use this to reach not just my neighbours? Well, maybe that's actually a start. Maybe that's all right. Maybe that's what it's for. But I suppose not just the people I sit next to in church. Not just use this gift on a Sunday morning for half an hour. But you've given me this to serve others, to administer your grace. Soren Kierkegaard, a Danish philosopher from the 19th century, he made this statement. It's quite a challenging statement. I'm going to read it out. It would be great if it was on the screen, but it's not. So you're just going to have to listen carefully because, you know, it's perhaps a little bit difficult to get your head around. He said this: it is dangerous to arrive in eternity with possibilities which one himself has prevented from becoming actualities. Sounds like a bit of a mouthful, doesn't it? I'll repeat it. It is a dangerous business to arrive in eternity with possibilities which one himself has prevented from becoming actualities. He goes on to say this: possibility is a hint from God. A person must follow it. If God does not want it, let him hinder it. The person must not hinder it himself. In short, what Kierkegaard is saying is if you have the potential to do something, like if you've been given a gift, if you're good at something, that is a hint from God. And you have a responsibility to run with that. And let, if you go in the wrong direction, let God pull you in. Let God rein you in. Don't be someone who gets before God at the end of all things and God says, what did you do with that? Oh, I was so excited to see what you were going to do. I placed this gift in you and I was going to use it to bring my grace to others. What did you do with it? And you say, nothing. Nothing. Don't be that person. Don't be that person. Think big. You and God sit down sometime and say, okay, God, you've made me good at this. How can we do something with this to bring your grace to others, to the whole world? Think big. Think creatively. What does Peter go on to say? He uses just two examples of gifts. He said, if anyone speaks, he should do it as one speaking the very words of God. If anyone serves, he should do it with the strength God provides, so that in all things God may be praised through Jesus Christ. So this is not about you kind of being clever and talented and being creative, you know, in your own strength. It's simply, I think Peter's saying, basically, if you are using God's gifts in the way God intends, then it's as if God himself is doing it. Is if God is doing it. I think we should be encouraged by this. I think we should expect God to use our gifts, to work through us. I think if we take that risk to think big about our gifts, to live for God's approval, not to use our gifts for people's approval, but for God's approval, and we take that risk, we should expect God to say, let's go. Let's do something with this. I think we can live that way. I think Peter encourages us to live that way. Okay, well, you've done well. I've had a great time doing this. I hope you've benefited it from it as well. I just want to conclude by bringing everything together with one final sort of challenge, if you like. Peter says, 1 Corinthians in verse 2, he's talking about following the example of Christ, saying if you follow the example of Christ, you do not live for the rest of your earthly life for evil human desires, but rather for the will of God. And I think, as far as epitaphs go, as far as things to be said at your graveside go, that is not bad either, is it? He lived for the will of God. She lived for the will of God. I tell you this, in all seriousness, if I die and someone stands at my funeral and says, oh, old what's his name, can't remember anything about him, but I know he lived for the will of God, I'm okay with that. Like, that would be I'd be happy with that. That would be a success for me, a successful life, to be known as someone who had great faith like the Canaanite woman, to be known as someone who lived for the will of God, that would be fine. Like, that would be all right. Now, there is a constant temptation, a constant pull, a constant desire to be drawn along by the crowd, to be spoken well of by the crowd, to have the crowd like you and approve of you and to honour you. But when we die, our lives will be summed up by a few words, and maybe a few words on the lips of the crowd. He was a good person. He was, look at what he achieved. Look at what she did. The crowd may say all those things about that. You know what? That is worth nothing compared to being someone who has on the word lips of God the words, you have great faith, or you lived for my will. I would trade any amount of applause from the crowd to just have that be the thing I'm remembered for.